Throughout history, generations in every world culture and society have passed on wisdom through stories. The ancient fables and tales offer life lessons, and they all contain archetypal characters. Consider the trickster, a creature or being that loves to create chaos. In Native American traditions, it takes many forms and appears in many stories. The first graphic anthology of some of those tales has just been published. Trickster combines folklore and comics. Matt Dembicki, who founded a comic creators collaborative here in Washington, edited the collection. He's also one of the illustrators, and he's here in our D.C. studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
In Native American lore, how many and what are the forms that the trickster takes?
I think there's many forms, and depending on the geographic area of the tribe, it will kind of dictate which animal or being it is. I think people are very familiar with coyote and the rabbit, perhaps not so familiar with the raccoon and the raven.
What was your vision for this collection?
Initially, the way it started is I was reading a prose book about tricksters and Native American trickster stories, and I just became fascinated with it. And coming from a cartoonist point of view, I started doodling and seeing what I could do, and I wanted to kind of incorporate perhaps some of the Native American look to the illustrations. And as I was doing it, it kind of dawned on me that this would be perhaps a really interesting collection.
How did you pair the storytellers with the illustrators?
The storyteller would send me their story, or they would recite it over the phone or something, and I would transcribe it. And I had like a pool of cartoonists, and I would kind of determine which three or four would do a good job illustrating it. And I made sure that they had a selection of styles from a cartoony style to a more realistic style. And then I would send samples to the storytellers who decided who they wanted to work with.
Oh.
And so it kind of gave them, I think, a little bit more buy-in into the process so they're more comfortable with it and to kind of, I guess, represent the vision that they had for the story.
The styles really... it's a wide range. I mean, you've got those moody, dark figures, you know, that you'd see in like The Dark Knight or something like mm-hmm. that. And then, I mean, there's one story, Rabbit's Choctaw Tale. Mm-hmm. That's hard to say three times fast. This one reminds me of the old Ren and Stimpy cartoons. tell us all a little bit about this one.
That one was illustrated by Pat Lewis, and he's very influenced by the Warner Brothers type of style from the 50s, cartoonists like Tex Avery. And like you said, it's just completely wild, and it's fun, and it's different. And that's just kind of, in terms of different styles, artistically, it worked out that way. I think it kind of represents what the storytellers themselves are like as individuals, what their preferences are. Some people prefer more realistic. Some people like the kind of fun, cartoony aspect of it.
Yeah. There's another one that I want you to talk about, and this is one that our listeners can actually hear. Joseph Stands With Many. He reads the story in an audio slideshow at our website, npr.org. But tell us the backstory of how Wildcat caught a turkey.
What I like particularly about this story is the kind of the simplicity of it. You know, it's not text heavy. And that's kind of one of the great things about cartooning is Joseph provided the story and John interpreted it in cartoons.
John the illustrator.
John Sperry, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's the person who did the artwork for it. And as you see here, almost the first three pages are textless.
Yeah.
In terms of how you move the story along. And it's not until the fourth page that you get some of the text in there. And a lot of it kind of focuses on food. The wildcat catches the rabbit, and the rabbit says, look, if you let me go, I promise you I'll be able to provide you with a meal. Some turkeys over there. And so the wildcat decides to kind of go with what the rabbit is telling him. And so he plays dead and kind of tricks the turkeys into coming over and looking at the wildcat. Huh. And, of course, the wildcat is not dead. He was just playing possum, essentially. So that's kind of I noticed that was kind of a theme in some of the stories in terms of playing possum.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Matt Dembicki, who is the editor of a new anthology of Native American tales called Trickster. Are there more tales to be told? I mean, do you think you might branch out to other cultures or other archetypal characters?
At this point, I don't think so. The reason is this project was really intense to find the storytellers and make them feel comfortable with the process. I think all the storytellers, except for maybe one person, weren't familiar with, well, they were familiar with comics, but they weren't familiar with how we'd be able to translate these stories into a comic form. There's a little bit of doubt about how we're going to do it, some cultural sensitivity. And so I think just winning the storyteller's confidence in that the book would be presented in an appropriate light took a while.
How did you finally get their confidence? I'm imagining you picking up the phone and calling one of these storytellers and say, how would you like to work on a graphic collection? I mean, what would you say on that particular phone call if they said, well, why would I want to do that?
You know, that was tough. It wasn't easy convincing everybody. Some people really couldn't see it being done this way. Other people had some cultural issues.
Yeah.
You know, they were very adamant about, you know, these are mostly oral stories. You know, they're told orally and they should be told orally. I had some interesting stories about some people who went back to their tribal elders and told them about the project, expecting them to say, well, we don't want to do this. We don't know where it's going to go. They came back and they said, you know, they're into it. They want to do it. And I think the reason they wanted to do it was, with all the competing media for people's attention, I think they felt they were losing a hold of their storytelling tradition, and they wanted to preserve some of these stories in a different format. It wasn't the ideal format for them, but they wanted to make sure that it was there, you know, to preserve it for their own children and for everyone else as well.
Matt Dembicki is an illustrator and the editor of Trickster, Native American Tales, a graphic collection. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
The HBO series True Blood starts its third season Sunday, and the latest Sookie Stackhouse novel is no doubt topping many readers' summer lists. Well, NPR's Margot Adler has read 100 vampire books this year, and she has reviews for us of two new novels, both expected to be summer blockbusters.
The most buzz is happening around The Passage by Justin Cronin. It's a brick at 766 pages with a blurb from Stephen King. A secret military experiment goes awry. The disease gets out of the lab, creates monsters, and the Earth is practically destroyed. The monsters are vampire-like in that they feed on blood, but they don't speak, and only a tiny spark of their old self remains. What makes The Passage gripping is the adventures of a group of survivors who are determined to find the source of the plague destroying their world. Protected by lights that may soon fail, they venture out into the destroyed world, fighting the monsters. They encounter small groups of survivors and a mysterious, voiceless girl who may hold the key to the origins of the disaster. The plot rarely lets you down, and some of the writing is so lyrical that you feel you are in the dystopian, ravaged world. The survivors have little knowledge of the world's history, but they create new culture, new language, and new social structures. This is the first book in a trilogy and ends with a threat still out there. The Passage may be almost 800 pages, but you will turn them quickly. It comes out tomorrow. The other book, also the first of a trilogy, is Blood Oath, which combines in a unique way a vampire novel and a presidential thriller. It sounds crazy, but stick with me. In 1867, in the time of President Andrew Johnson, a young man named Nathaniel Cade is attacked by a vampire while working on a whaling ship. Overwhelmed by hunger and to his own diminishing horror, he feeds on his best friend. He is imprisoned and later pardoned from a death sentence by the president, who binds him with a blood oath, compelling Cade to be a secret agent and protect all U.S. presidents. 140 years later, Nathaniel Cade is taciturn and cold. A hunter and killer who believes himself damned but is still a Christian. He wears a cross, even though it hurts. He objects to words of blasphemy and even goes to AA meetings to deal with his own bloodlust. Like Spock in Star Trek, he seems emotionally dead but fascinating. The novel begins when Cade's old handler is retiring and Zack Barrow is hired to replace him. Young, ambitious, and a Washington insider, Barrow dreams of being chief of staff. Instead, he's given this new assignment and told of a hidden world. His relationship with Cade and his growing maturity in what is clearly a bizarre and dangerous job is the most compelling aspect of the novel. The various evils, a former Nazi scientist who wants to create Frankenstein monsters, a jihadist group that wants to use such evils, a shadow CIA, all seem a bit predictable. But there is pure fun here as well. A whole bunch of pseudo-documents, including a hilarious explanation for the missing 18 minutes in the Nixon tapes. Cade has no love for humanity. His long life makes him view human foibles with some disdain. The best vampire novels struggle with moral questions. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to use power wisely? Cade struggles with his vanishing humanity, and author Christopher Farnsworth has the potential to create an even more interesting character in book two.
NPR's Margot Adler. You can find all our summer picks at npr.org/summerbooks.
Many people know the story by now, how a 19-year-old Harvard sophomore started Facebook in his college dorm room. Ancient history. That was 2003. Nearly a half billion people now use Mark Zuckerberg's social networking site. Still, Facebook has yet to make a profit, and there are many questions over privacy raised by users and now some governments. David Kirkpatrick is the author of a new book, The Facebook Effect. Good morning.
Good to be here.
Before we get to the privacy issues, I'd like to talk a bit about Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. You had amazing access to him. What's his worldview, and how does that shape what Facebook is?
Well, he sees the world as increasingly opening up on and off Facebook. And from the day he first created his system, he had this ethos of sharing that he strongly believed in. You know, the history of humanity has basically been in villages and small towns. And in that context, people pretty much knew each other's business. It's very interesting to me that a system created by a guy like Mark Zuckerberg, which is all about sort of getting inside the business of your friends, has emerged just at the moment when we're all moving to cities, because it actually suggests that we can maybe make this transition and retain some of the same dynamic we had in the small town.
And the investment firms are saying that Facebook is worth over $10 billion. What exactly?
More than that, actually. The latest transactions put it in the $25, $26 billion range.
It's extraordinary. So what's so valuable?
Well, in the United States, where about 125 million people use Facebook at least once a month, the average of those Americans, according to Nielsen, is they're spending 7 hours a month there. So you have 125 million Americans spending 7 hours a month, and then you look at it, it's 500 million worldwide. You know, this is just something that you can't disregard. It's a massive, massive way that people are spending their time.
Well, I must say, reading the book, it's very clear that the money part of this almost came as a surprise.
Well, I think if there's a theme to the book, the theme is that Zuckerberg is not building a business. He's building what he considers to be a social movement. And I really do think that's what he thinks. Now, he does think they'll make money over time. It's just that he doesn't make that his priority. The way he's always looked at it is, let's get ubiquity, and once we do, then we'll figure out how to, quote unquote, monetize this thing.
Let's talk about some of the bigger ideas that surround this notion of privacy. Zuckerberg talks about transparency. It's the utmost importance, he says. What he is talking about is you can't have two personas, the professional face and your personal face. How realistic is that?
Well, that's a really tough question to answer. I mean, he says, and I have a whole chapter, as you may have noticed, which is subtitled, "You Have One Identity," which is a quote from him. And he believes that he will live a better life personally, and all of us will be more honest, and ultimately it will be better for the world if we dispense with all of that facade. That's his personal belief. But it's quite interesting that someone holding that belief has succeeded in building a system that 500 million people use.
You do write, though, that 30% of employers have rejected applicants because of things they found on Facebook.
So Facebook or other social networks.
So there's a consequence to having one personality.
Right. Well, I think, frankly, anybody who puts secret data about themselves on Facebook or any place on the internet is naive if they think it's not potentially going to get seen by others.
You have some remarkable examples, which raises questions about personal responsibility. For example, the new head of British intelligence.
I love that example.
After he was named, it turned out that his wife had been posting pictures of his children and details of his address.
Right.
Prison guards who friend prisoners. In trials, jurors who have posted opinions on Facebook during deliberations.
Right.
You don't have to post that. Do you think that users have something to learn as well?
Well, they definitely do. And you probably also noticed that there's a legal scholar who wrote a long paper last year in which he said he believes a large percentage of what we consider privacy problems on Facebook are what he calls peer-to-peer privacy violations, where our friends, quote unquote, are the ones exposing data about ourselves in ways that we don't like.
One of the themes of your book is the privacy issues are not new, and they've been quite heated with Facebook users over time. Do you think that this is a way that this community, everybody who's on Facebook, is beginning to determine what exactly privacy is?
You mean it's sort of a user-generated decision-making process?
Indeed.
In effect? Yes, we live in an explosive world of data production, and much of that data is about ourselves. And there's not much we can do about it with the extraordinary, you know, marketing apparatus that exists to try to target us both on and off the internet. And we all just act so much digitally. We create data about ourselves at a phenomenal rate. So, you know, I think there's another side to it. There's a certain anonymity in obscurity. As the quantity of data about us grows, the fact that any given piece of data about us might be exposed in the world probably becomes less problematic over time, because similar data is increasingly being exposed about everyone else we know. Therefore, it's less remarkable. And I think whether or not Facebook continues to grow, I think that's going to be the case. And we almost certainly will be less concerned about privacy more and more as time goes on.
Is it possible that it will be governments and not the U.S. government that will push more on this privacy issue?
Well, a number of them have already. You may have noticed just a week or so ago, the Pakistani government was considering shutting down Facebook in Pakistan because there was a group called Everybody Draw Muhammad Day. And that was considered sacrilegious by Muslims in Pakistan. And Facebook actually ended up removing the group, even though technically it wasn't a violation of its terms of service. You know, when you have a genuinely global system like this and all the different value systems that it encounters in being global, I think it's quite amazing all the challenges it's going to face from government. As I end the book, I say clearly, and I do believe this, there's no way Facebook is going to avoid substantial regulatory pushback in many ways because of the exposure of data, because of the way that it's trying to become an identity sort of infrastructure and maintaining even what might be considered a passport for the internet, when that sort of function has always been done by government in the past.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
David Kirkpatrick is the author of The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world.